I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 25, Ghosts in the Machine.
Dear Matt, let's begin this week with our friends in the visual arts. Hi, visual artists. Painters, printmakers, photographers, all sorts of visual artists use the term negative space to describe the area of a canvas that sits outside the primary image. The classic example of this is the picture of the ornate vase. Vase? Vase? You know, a flower pot. That, as you look at it, reveals the silhouettes of two faces, one to its right, one to the left. The faces are the negative space. And what's interesting is, once you see them, it becomes impossible to unsee them. Your brain can successfully switch between the vase and the faces, but once it knows to see two sets of images and not just one, that's what it sees. It makes a second image out of nothing and holds it. And the second image alters what you see in the canvas forever. So let's talk this week about negative space in creativity, about what we leave out, and how it colors our perceptions of what we put in. The writer and writing coach Anne Lamott likes to say that the most useful thing a writer can do is write a first draft that's trash. In our two-writer household, Jennifer and I refer to this as the vomit draft. A terrible first draft is useful, it's essential in fact, because once you've thrown down every idea you have, you can begin headhunting the bad ones and carving them away. It's easy to think of this process in a linear way. You find the stuff that weakens your writing or the stuff you've said poorly, and you eliminate it, and that's it. But I've been thinking about this pruning in terms of negative space, the space at the edges, the space left behind. How do those spaces affect our process, affect the result? When we look at a piece of creative work, can we see the thing that isn't there? I think we can. And I'm going to do my best to talk about it without going all mystical or invoking Scatman Crothers in The Shining.
You know, Doc, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind. Say, like, if someone burns toast.
When you read a piece of writing, everything you take in, the pace, the structure, the rhythm, all of it, reflects a series of choices. Mark Twain said, "The writing begins when you've finished. Only then do you know what you're trying to say." In other words, the shape of the writing is inevitably dictated by the things that have been cut away. You may not see them on the page, but they're there. Ghosts in the machine. We've talked before about a piece I wrote for Newsweek in the late 80s, when I somehow convinced my editor, Dominique Browning, to greenlight a caper in which I flew to Las Vegas and wrote a real-time diary of that year's Jerry Lewis telethon for muscular dystrophy. When I returned to New York, somewhat the worse for wear, I wrote a draft that significantly overran the space allotted because that's what the story called for. And if you don't believe me, because you're unfamiliar with the annual televised freakout that was the Labor Day telethon, watch any random clip of it on YouTube. It will change you. Anyway, after Dominique had read the original draft, she called me into her office and gestured vaguely at the enormous printout sitting on her desk. "Okay," she said, "I get it. I see what you're doing. You want me to kill this so you can sell it to Rolling Stone." To her credit, she didn't, and it ran in Newsweek in an abbreviated version. And here's the thing about that version. It was the product of a skillful edit by an editor who knew her business. It works on its own merits. But if you were to read both versions back to back, you'd begin to trace the outlines of the longer piece in the shorter one. You'd see the places where transitions had been created, where thoughts had been elided, where others had been teased apart and bolstered. You'd see the published piece differently. Is this a little bit of a thought exercise? Sure. Most people see a creative work in one form, its finished one. But it can be interesting to look for those little joins and gaps. Can you see them in the work of other performers? In the spirit of the thing, I'll simply say here, next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, negative space is only negative space when we decide it is. As you say, once our brains can see the two faces, it's no longer the space around the vase. It's an alternative image, a new way of seeing. Space is never just space. It's always something. Even actual space is made up of hydrogen and helium plasma, dust, and smells like burnt steak. I just wanted to slide that fact in. It's not relevant. In visual arts, even when there's not an optical illusion in play, when the negative space around the object of an image is just negative space, it's still not nothing. Its shape and placement has been carefully, artistically chosen to have function, to draw the eye to something else, or to balance the image and perhaps say something about the rest of the frame by doing that. So what about me? Well, what I wear on stage is, to me, also a kind of faces vase thing. My costume is a statement on what I'm not wearing, that being the kind of things that circus performers usually wear. I don't look like what I've just told them I am. So hopefully that makes me immediately, even if just minimally, interesting. You ask if I can smell Scatman Crothers' burnt toast in other people's work, and yeah, perhaps sometimes. You can get a sense of the structure someone's working with and the way they've cut the fat out of it to make it flow better. But more often, perhaps, I can see the parts that need to be edited away. It's nice to see an act develop over months and years where perhaps it started as weaker, more self-indulgent, but the more audiences it gets shown to, stuff gets trimmed, stuff gets cut. It gets tighter, stronger, punchier. You can see that one kind of negative space shrinking. I've been thinking about the way I use negative space, and I'm reminded of something my friend Fraser, who happens to be one of the greatest clowns in the world, mentioned to me after watching my show recently. I always have my stage set the same way for my act. My main prop of a dining table to the far right of me, and my suitcase to the far left. Fraser mentioned how much I walk between the two when I work. That negative space between the two bits of stage furniture, that is where the show happens. Maybe my whole art form is about the stuff people can't see. They can't see the practice, but they know it was there. Your brain can see the vase or the two faces, but without either one, there's neither. I've done some stand-up comedy. I was okay at it, but it didn't really interest me as something to pursue, so I got bored and stopped. But when people watch my act, I like to think that I deliver my funnies as good as any comic would. And that's at least partly because I was, for a little bit, a comic. I don't make that kind of toast on stage anymore, but you can still smell it when I talk in between tricks. In a way, a street show is a story of negative space. That big piazza, empty, until the performer attracts people and fills it. But still, always, the defining feature of that art form is where it happens. That all there was before and after the show is space. I cut some stuff for this piece, too. I really wanted to tell a story about the old British comedian Freddie Parrotface Davis. Yes, that's his name. Freddie Parrotface Davis. The story is vaguely applicable to our theme, but in the end, I decided it wasn't applicable enough, so instead, I mentioned it here and figured that his name is so fantastic that you'll be unable to resist asking about him. Or maybe it would be more fun if you don't. Leave that as negative space forever. I also cut a long bit about an old street performing joke and how I once saw someone leave out the part that made it make sense. That was a harder edit because it was a funny story, But again, it was maybe a bit of a stretch thematically, so out it went. I've talked before about how I often write my segments of our podcast in a bit of a train of thought frenzy. But this one has felt a bit harder. It's almost like the theme of the episode is influencing how I'm making it. There's been more editing than usual. I've been more in my head. So I wonder if you can sense that. Well, either way, I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I'm intrigued by this notion that your show happens in the space between your table and your suitcase. Now, that's a literal thing, of course. It's the real estate you travel over the course of your set. But it's also a metaphorical one. It's the space between preparation and execution. In that space, you can see, by implication, the stuff that didn't work and got trimmed away. It isn't always easy for the audience to see those things, but yes, they can feel them. Remember Conan Doyle's story about the dog that didn't bark? You must, because you're British. Sometimes those little subliminal bumps, those vestiges, are the dog that didn't bark. They're there in transitions that feel a little bumpy, or in a piece that doesn't build to something greater than its parts. Let's stay with performance for a second. I think that may be where it's easiest to see what I'm talking about. What is it that takes a stand-up like, say, Mike Birbiglia, and makes him a theatrical performer? I'm not saying there's anything wrong with stand-up or that it's somehow a lesser thing than theater, but how did Birbiglia travel that distance and end up with pieces that are rooted in stand-up but yield the cumulative emotional impact of theater? One way is by collaborating with an outside director. Most recently, in Birbiglia's case, it's been a guy called Seth Barish. We've talked before about getting some distance from your work so you can see it more clearly. That's what Barish helps Birbiglia do, scanning for the things that aren't yet there, mining the material for deeper currents, and shaping it to build to an emotional climax. When audiences feel the lift that comes with a well-conceived theatrical piece, they're also feeling the absence of the little shorn-away bits that may have held earlier versions earthbound. Here's another example, closer to home. When I edit the audio for these episodes of ours, part of that process is pacing. I take our raw tracks and either add or subtract empty spaces between phrases. Mostly I do this to give what we're saying a more conversational flow, but sometimes it's more than that. I'll frequently add a bit of silence after a key thought, so that thought lands more decisively, so that the listener's attention has a moment to focus on it. It's a way of directing the listener's ear where we want it to go. These are negative spaces, and without them, our audio tracks would be subtly different. The listener would hear where those spaces weren't. This is admittedly heady stuff we're talking about. If this one's felt a little harder for you to get your head around, which it sounds like it has been, well, it has for me too. Full disclosure, we may also be feeling the cumulative drag of a full season coasting to a stop before we take a little break to recharge. That's part of the process too. It may be reaching to call our between seasons breaks a kind of negative space, but I don't know, maybe not. They're liminal spaces, at least. Maybe the rest and reflection that happen in those breaks help to define the parameters of what we say when we come back. It isn't a reach, I don't think, to suggest that the time spent in those breaks contributes as much to the overall arc of the show as the time we spend actively writing and producing. I took the bait, as you knew I would, and looked up Freddie Parrotface Davis. And I was absolutely delighted to discover that he was, along with the great George Carl, one of the leads in a movie that we both love, Peter Chelsom's Funny Bones. Davis and Carl played the Parker Brothers, a vaudeville duo spending their declining years wasting away on the Blackpool amusement pier before an old secret bubbles to the surface and opens the door to an unlikely comeback. It's a magnificent and a very strange comedy drama, and I recommend it highly. I'm curious to know what the Davis bit was that you decided didn't belong, if you can share it without fully heading down the road toward a place you decided not to go. And if you can't, that's fine. Sometimes a shorn-away bit has its own value. Writers habitually keep a document where they hang on to bits that have been cut from a draft because everything is inventory and you never know when you're going to reconsider something. Everybody has a different name for these documents. I just call mine scraps. Your Davis scrap at least sent me back toward Funny Bones and reminded me how much I love it. Let me leave you with this. Is negative space only worth thinking about for creators? Or is it something that audiences should take into account? Can they take it into account when they're considering how they feel about a work of creation? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, yes, the great Freddie Parrotface Davis was indeed one half of the brothers in the wonderful movie Funny Bones, alongside the owner of the funniest silent 10-minute act in the history of entertainment, George Carl. Also in that very underrated film, a cavalcade of talent, Jerry Lewis, Lee Evans, Leslie Caron, Oliver Reed, Oliver Platt, and, in an ever so slightly smaller role, me. Yeah, shot 3 scenes and they almost all got cut, but you can still catch me standing at the back of a group shot behind a live llama. That's showbiz. So, since you took the bait, here's the story. I'm on pretty good terms with Freddie Davis, and a good number of years ago, he invited me to an event he was having because I think he wanted my feedback on it, which was very sweet of him. He was holding a performance masterclass where he would, live on stage, give the audience some insights into his techniques and philosophies of performing. Parrotface started performing in cabaret in the early 60s, and as a comedian, actor, and clown, has done his thing pretty much everywhere where his thing can be done. From cabaret clubs to the biggest theatres to TV to Harry Potter movies and, of course, Funny Bones. So, when he asks if you want to listen to his thoughts on performing and if you're not an idiot, you say yes. The evening itself was very enjoyable. If I'm honest, it was heavier on the stories from his career than actionable advice, but that was fine with me. He did, however, mention one little trick that he said he always used. And here's where I bring us back on track with the subject of this episode, the spaces in between the stuff, the gaps. He said that at the end of his show, he always took one single bow and then would stand there, motionless, staring the audience in the eyes. And the audience would be unable to stop clapping. He played this game of chicken with them. He'd stand there, taking the ovation, almost daring them to stop clapping while he was looking right at them. It was, at the same time, a way of creating a really lovely theatrical moment and a brilliantly cynical old vaudeville trick to blackmail them into loving you as much as they can. He mentioned this in the middle of the evening, which meant that at the end of the night, when he took his final bow and did exactly this, it took a while for the audience to realise he was playing the same trick on them. And as the applause continued, laughter got added in. Perfect. You wonder what makes Mike Birbiglia transcend stand-up to be more theatrical. And sure, a director can do that, but I think it's a little bit wider. I think one of the marks of a good performer, especially in a medium that's a little insular as stand-up comedy certainly is if they remember that what they do is a subset of theatre. Once you stop thinking of yourself as just a comedian, or a busker, or a wrestler, or a burlesque performer, or whatever, and realise that it's all theatre, just different flavours, then it opens your mind to what you can do. Funnily enough, I'm currently writing a lecture that I've been asked to give to a theatre full of magicians, and this is the core of it. That a magic show is theatre, and the more you think of it that way, and the less you think of it as a magic show, then the higher the chance you'll end up doing something original and interesting with it. It's a way, perhaps, of stretching artistically into that space that all the forms of theatre exist in, like planets in a solar system. Or maybe I'm just desperately trying to find a way to tie it into this week's theme. And yes, the document where you put your ideas that don't have a home yet. Yours is called Scraps. Mine is called Scratchpad, because that's what one of my very few influential teachers, Dr. Harris, used to call it when I was a kid in his computer science class. So, whenever I use it, I think of him and the rides home he used to sometimes give me in his big, battered blue Land Rover. So, what is negative space for an audience? Well, when the performer does nothing, they are, by definition, enforcing that space on their audience, challenging them to do something, or nothing, with it. Either fill it with the applause that Freddie Parrotface Davis has engineered, or just all sit together and share a moment of nothing in a place that was made for lots of noisy somethings. We've also been talking about the kind of spaces created by things that the performer leaves out or has cut. And when we flip that around on a live audience, well, I've certainly experienced them leaving out a laugh when I thought there should be one. There's a space that everyone notices. Negative space in a performance can certainly mean something to an audience, especially if they are clued into what might have filled that space. When my friend, the wonderful drag queen Michael Twaits, sings Fairy Tale of New York in their Christmas show, they take out the line that contains a homophobic slur and replace it with a line sung by their pianist that insults Michael directly and personally. It always gets a huge reaction, partly because they didn't say something that's mean to a community, and partly because his pianist did say something mean, but just mean to Michael. It's all the funnier because everyone knows what's not there and what they chose to replace it with. As a performer, it takes a bit of experience to see the benefit in cutting things, in doing less, in leaving spaces. And it takes some confidence to follow through with that idea. There are a couple of moments in my act when I engineer silence, and it always feels powerful and cool. I think audiences really like the almost magical thing of all of us somehow agreeing to be quiet for a few seconds. It's rare, unexpected, and somehow, maybe because it's a sort of group decision, it reminds us all of how many of us there are. And then, usually because I'm the kind of performer that I am, I punctuate that gorgeous silence with something big and surprising and noisy, which gets a far stronger reaction because the silence made everyone lean in. I left out the bit where I could have told them to watch carefully, to not blink, to wait for it, but it's more powerful and simpler to just say, shh. I did consider taking out the bit that I usually say here, where I tell you that I'll talk to you soon, but I guess I've just said it anyway. Matt.
Dear Matt, I appreciate the diligence you showed in bringing your anecdote about Parrot Face Davis back around to the nominal topic of this episode, but you didn't really have to. Sometimes a good digression is its own reward. I'll confess that I gave a few minutes thought to how to bring that fact back around to the topic of this episode, but I'm not going to. Wow. Meta. Instead, let's talk about you saying that as a performer, you definitely noticed the space where a laugh should be. You moved on from that thought pretty quickly. I guess it was more or less a punchline to you, but it landed differently with me. It brought me up short and sent my thoughts careening back to my days as a sitcom writer. You function as both the writer and performer of your show, so when that awful silence happens, it's, well, it's awful, but it's also a pretty uncomplicated thing. You wrote it, it died, you move on. In the setting of a sitcom, though, or a film or a play, that is, a piece where there are both writers and performers, that gap, that nothing where something should be, is a double-edged sword. It cuts the performers, but it does so shallowly, because they can, and sometimes do, make it clear that they're just saying somebody else's thoughts, that it isn't their fault. This is considered bad sportsmanship, but it happens. I've told the story before about the actor who died a death with the line I'd written, and reacted by throwing his script across the soundstage floor, which was a shockingly disrespectful thing to do, and also kind of superfluous, because it was a rehearsal, and everybody there, from the camera operators to the grips to the hair and makeup people, knew he didn't make the line up. To a writer, the sword cuts so much deeper. The silence that lands with a wet, queasy sploosh where a laugh was supposed to be is the worst possible sound because the writer is ground zero for that failed line or piece of business. The writer has no place to hide. He is, in that moment, literally the author of his own pain. He has been individually and specifically identified as a hack, a no talent, a zero. What's worse is, and this is maybe more directly on point to what we're talking about, which I think is still the things we leave out, at least it was when I started writing this segment back in the late 60s, what's worse is there is a material cost to that gap, that nothingness in the air. And it's particularly noticeable in the context of comedy, because comedy is a delicate thing. It's a souffle. The slightest ripple of disturbance in the air can make it go flat and dead. Any writer, or for that matter, performer of comedy, can tell you that when a bit dies on its feet, it alters the temperature of the room, and it takes time to get it back up to where you want it to be. This may account for why actors react with particular hostility to writers in these moments, not only because they've been embarrassed, and being actors, they have the emotional resilience of toddlers, it's also because it's largely on them to restore whatever momentum the performance may have had, while the writers slink off to craft services and drown their sorrows in donuts. So, and it's been a long way around to get here. Yes, there are times when negative space is very real to an audience and materially affects how they perceive the piece. I guess I should have started by saying that, but better late than never. You talked about the moments in your act when you engineer silence. I think what you're describing is a version of the trick good public speakers use when they deliberately lower their volume to make the audience lean in. They manufacture attention. Among many others, the late governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, was known for this. It occurs to me that this is a way of harnessing that inertial shift that happens when a bit dies and leaves a gap where a laugh should be, of making it work for you. Is that how it feels to you? All right, Matt, bring us home for the season. It's been fun hanging out with you for season 3. And I'll talk to you soon in season 4. Take care. Bill.
Dear Bill, I have, of course and obviously, never ever experienced a gag falling flat during a show firsthand. Any and all of the insight I might have about it comes only from watching my fellow performers crash and burn like the schmucks they are before I take the stage and have yet another faultless, perfect barnstormer of a set. Okay, fine. One of the first and biggest times I died on my arse was one of the first times I'd ever worked a London comedy club. It was the late 80s, I'd done a couple of years as a street performer, so I had some kind of idea what I was doing, and I thought I'd give the growing comedy circuit a try. I landed a tryout spot at the Bearcat Club in southwest London. At the time, I was playing with a nerdy kind of character, so I thought it might be funny to come on stage and then walk off and then come back on, as if I was unsure of it all before suddenly busting out a big opening trick. I never got to the opening trick. The first two rows of drunk rugby fans mistook my character's reticence for genuine nerves on my part. They started chanting and then ended up reaching onto the front of the stage, grabbing my own props and throwing them at me. I got off the stage as fast as I could, gathered my stuff, left out the back door and cried my way home, convinced that this was not in any way the job for me. So if this episode is about the spaces, well, my gag failing to land didn't create a silence. I would have killed for a silence. It created a mob. But it did create some space in my head, in my soul, maybe, which I was forced to fill with questions about my future. You're right that someone like me can't throw his metaphorical script across the room and blame the writer because that's also me. But what it takes away in terms of perceived responsibility, it gives in terms of agility in the moment. When a gag falls flat, and there will never be a time when that doesn't happen, even if just super occasionally, you have options, tactics. First things first, learn to not care. You're not a magician doing a trick, where if you screw up one tiny part of it, you're sunk. The chances are that the audience wanted to laugh and they're there for a good time, so all you have to do is get to the next laugh smoothly. And not look disappointed or annoyed at the silence where the laugh should have been. Comedy, as you say, is a souffle, and what makes it go flat and limp, more than one gag not landing, is the performer, because of that, losing their nerve. Or even worse, getting angry at the audience. Unless, of course, that's the best way to the next laugh. I actually have a gag in my act that really gets much more than a medium-sized laugh, and often much, much less, but I keep it in because A, I like it, and B, when they don't laugh as much as I think they should, I tell them that, and I tell them it's my favourite gag, and then I get upset that they didn't like it, which itself gets a bigger laugh and suits my onstage persona of being easily irritated. When I'm doing my street show, one of the parts I'm most proud of involves engineering a silence. I'm gearing up for my big finale, and I tell the audience that I want them to give me a countdown, a 3, 2, 1. We rehearse, and because I tell them to go before they're quite ready, they don't really get it together to do it loudly. "It's okay," I say. "We'll break it down." So I split the audience into 4 sides. For each side, one after another, I turn to them and say, "Go!" And they say, 3, 2, 1. Until the final side, which is always to my left, when I turn in the other direction to face them, and just ever so slightly break the rhythm of when I say go. And the result is, almost every time, a complete failure on their part. Almost complete silence, usually with a few lone voices saying 3, 2, 1, and nervous giggling. To everyone else, it seems like for some odd reason, one quarter of the audience spontaneously lost the ability to count. I react confused, I check if they're okay, I apologize to the rest of the audience, and we do it again, and I make it happen again. And then finally I give them a 3rd try, I let them gather themselves, get ready, do it properly, which of course in itself gets a nice big cheer from the other people, and we move on. I love that bit so much, because when it works it seems to just happen, as if the audience are witnessing an odd, unique, one-time thing. And of course, in that situation, it's the silence that creates the laugh. So, we're talking about spaces and gaps, and we're about to take one ourselves. This is the 25th episode of Imagination and Junk, and the last episode of Season 3. We really hope you enjoyed it, and if you have, then recommending it to your friends would mean a lot. We've been talking about the gaps that happen when you leave something out, but that's not what's happening here. Sometimes, often I think, gaps, space, are an essential part of the creative process. The frisson of having ideas, of planning, making, producing, is a wonderful, life-affirming thing. But the counterpoint to that should be sometimes not doing those things, setting the switch in your head to receive rather than transmit. To let the world soak into you for a while, so that when you finally flick that switch back, you're fully charged. So we'll be doing that, but we'll be back soon with a couple more very special and very silly episodes of I Might Be Wrong But, where one of us fails to convince the other one that something we like is great. And then, after that, we'll be getting started on Season 4. So, enjoy the space, and we'll talk to you soon.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.